Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the third and final part of this mini-series with world-leading cult expert Dr. Alexandra Stain. In the second segment, Alexandra broke down why certain terminology in the space of cult education is used and why it shouldn't always be avoided. In this third and final part, there is a focus on Alexandra's charity work and what she is currently focused on with her life's work. For early access to ad-free full-length episodes, please visit patreon.com/thecultvault to support this show from as little as £1 a month. But for now, here is Dr. Alexandra Stain. The charity that you are with, we've mentioned a bit now, and I'd really like to dedicate sort of the last portion of our interview to speaking about all of the work that happens with the Family Survival Trust, because it's an incredible foundation that also does a lot of that prevention work that you've mentioned. So the Family Survival Trust, can you tell us all about the organization and your work within it?
We're tiny. We have almost no resources, but we punch above our weight, you know. And I think part of that is because it has a long history. It was founded probably around 40 years ago, and it was originally under a different name, and it was FAIR for a while. Anyway, so a few years ago, it changed its name to the Family Survival Trust and became a charity. And it had originally been started by parents in the 70s who had lost children to cults. And then over the years, it's kind of morphed where we still work a little bit with parents, mostly mothers, not many. We don't get many fathers who've lost kids to cults, but we're more now first and second generation. So, you know, people recruited and people born or raised in cults, and increasingly people born and raised are being involved and seeking help. And what we do, so again, we're very small, and please donate to us. We're desperate for funds. We want to hire our first person to help with some of our technical work, and you can donate to us by going to the Family Survival Trust, familysurvivaltrust.org, and we have a donate button. So having done that pitch, because I'm having to learn to ask for money for the trust, which I'm not very good at. But we've kind of got three main things we work on. So we have an annual public education presentation where we get a speaker who's, you know, got something to say in the field. We had a wonderful talk last year by Elgin Strait, who does the Falling Out podcast. He was really great. And I encourage anyone to check his podcast out.
Absolutely. Elgin's talk with you all was my introduction to the Family Survival Trust. And I remember joining the Zoom call and looking at all the names and being like, half of these people I've interviewed on the show and the other half are like people I would love to speak to about their knowledge in the field. So I was kind of sitting there like a little bit almost starstruck by the people that were there. So anybody that's interested in really I don't know, like rubbing shoulders, I guess, with the industry itself. Then there's the Family Survival Trust. Elgin's talk was incredible about parentification, which is something we've talked a lot about on the show, in regards to the Unification Church. And of course, we know that a lot of these destructive groups, especially fundamentalist religious groups, and evangelical religious groups, have kids raising kids, which is almost like its own pandemic across the globe. So Elgin's perspective on that, as somebody who was born and raised in the Unification Church, was incredible. I'm sure there's still a copy of that floating around somewhere as well. Is that
his presentation is on the website of the FamilySurvivalTrust.org. So you can find it there. Yeah, it was great. And then I believe this coming year, we're going to be having Julie Jenkinson talk about her new book, which is her kind of recovery workbook, which is going to be really helpful for people. I think that's what's going to happen. So that's one thing that we do, is these kind of public education presentations. We have our support group, which has been really lively, especially since the pandemic, because like everyone else, we had to go on Zoom. So we went from meeting in central London with whoever could make it into London to now being quite international. We have people from around the world, and that seems to work really well. That's it's very kind of loose structure, but also we work really hard at facilitating it well, so people feel safe. So that's a big part of our work right now, is running the support group. And then our third thing is trying to do policy work. And, from my perspective, there's three things that need to happen. Prevention, which is you do through education, much more than our presentations. We need to get education into the schools and the universities. We're a long way from that, but hopefully eventually. Recovery, which we sort of cover with the support group. And then the policy part is really about criminalizing these behaviors and sanctioning groups and leaders that engage in coercive control. So to that end, we this year published, I think, quite a significant report where we interviewed 105, I think was the final number. It was an in-depth survey. So kind of a self-interview in a way, with a lot of long answers as well as short ones, of people who had been in cults in the UK or cults that were based in the UK. So you kind of have to do policy work on a more national basis, which hopefully can provide models for other countries, but, laws are done nationally. So, and we structured the interview according to the features that are laid out in an existing coercive control law in the UK about what are the patterns of behaviors that are now criminalized in the UK, but only if they occur within intimate or family relationships. And our argument is that if it's illegal to do that within your home to somebody, to coercively control them, why is it legal for your neighbor to do it to you, or the church down the road, or at your workplace? These exact same patterns of behavior should be illegal wherever they occur. That's kind of our argument. Because the behaviors they lay out in the guidelines for that law are exactly what happened in cults. They are no different, because it's that same human dynamic of isolate people, make them think they're in a safe place, and then frighten the bejesus out of them. That's what happens. And control, all these different ways of controlling them. So we got a really rich amount of data from that survey, and with great difficulty and some wonderful people helping us, that got written up into a report. It really was not an easy task. And that's available on our website as well. And that goes along with a legislative recommendation, which is to expand that law to include non-intimate or family relationships. So we're sort of taking that around, hoping to get it to MPs. So anyone who's listening, who's got an MP, they want to alert to this. You can find that report on our website. Please, please, please take it to your MP's surgery and tell them they need to get involved, because every single constituency has many, many people in it who are in cults or who are and surviving that experience. So, yeah.
Am I right in thinking that there was a figure included in the report as well that determined how many active cults there may be currently in the UK?
Yes, but I don't want to focus too much on that because we don't really know. You know, I mean, so I think we use the figure 2000 because that was in a BBC broadcast and that's a sort of known source. But I'm always leery of these figures. You know, of these people that we interviewed, and we just put out a kind of announcement on social media, and I think within 2 or 3 weeks we got these 105 people. So it wasn't like we didn't try that hard, in other words. And they represent 36 different cults. Now, we know this is a tiny tip of the iceberg. And it's very hard to know how many cults there are because, first of all, no one's doing that research. Second of all, a lot of them are secret and nobody knows they exist. So, you know, it's a very tricky thing. But so we pick these numbers, and 2000 is probably as good as any other number. It's definitely in the thousands. I have no doubt about that, just from my own experience. And there's hundreds of thousands of people in cults in the UK. We can, I think, come up with that figure because there's some very big cults. Yeah, the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Exclusive Brethren and many others.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The recent Guardian coverage on the House of Lords inviting Nithyananda to come and speak, and given a fugitive who has warrants out for child sexual abuse and the worst of human crimes, has been given access to British politicians in the House of Lords. So this is obviously, I don't know if this is something that's happened intentionally. I don't know if this is something that's happened by mistake. I don't know if we'll ever truly know, because that's the nature of these things. But it's a good way for me to ask you if you think that what are the reasons behind the law not being extended? Is it because a lot of these groups have tax exempt status, which they've been given from HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs? And that would look bad on some people in the country if these groups were to be told to disband or to be given some kind of legal penalty? Or is it because there are certain groups or certain political parties in the country that benefit from having associations with groups that have the title of cult?
I think this is a difficult question. I think the chair of our charity, Tom Sackville, who's been dealing with this, you know, policy stuff for years and is a former MP himself, I think he feels there's a couple of things I've heard him say. One is that there are large religious institutions like the Catholic Church and so forth that don't want to get in a position of where they get confused. I think they're confused about the religious thing. Like, we don't want to ban religions. We want to ban these criminal organizations. But I think there's a lot of confusion and they don't want anyone stepping on their toes. So I think that's one thing. The other thing he talks about a lot is that it's kind of difficult. It's a, you know, you have to learn something to understand this. And this is somewhat new, even though, you know, I gave the history of the sociology of knowledge around this, but, you know, it doesn't go back that far, does it? You know, we're just talking World War II. So we're still developing knowledge about this, and it's a bit complicated. And as Tom Sackville would say, you know, the civil servants want to go home at 5 o'clock. And I'm not sure, you know, I trust him on that. You know, he knows a lot about how things work. I think, and then, you know, there's other complexities. Like, first of all, it always astounds me the lack of Google usage that these people use. It's like, you know, there's all these vetting requirements for, you know, terrorist organizations. And it's a little bit racist, actually. Anyway, you know, so if I want to go teach at a university, do a guest lecture, I have to present my passport. They have to vet me. You know, it's a whole nonsense. But, you know, if it's a religious group, oh, just come on in. You know, well, to like the Lords, it's like Google. Just use your Google. Google is your friend. You know, and they don't seem to do this. And then the other element is that, of course, I mean, right now I can tell you that Suella Braverman belongs to Truratna, which is a cult where I have worked with people who've come out of that cult. It's a so-called Buddhist cult. The former policy advisor at Number 10 for Boris Johnson, Munira Mirza, is part of Spiked Online, which used to be the Revolutionary Communist Group. I mean, it defeats the imagination, I know, but that was a cult. And Claire Fox, these big people in Brexit, she's now in the House of Lords, and all these other people go back 30 years together in this political cult, which you can find if you Google. And the newspapers don't seem to give a damn about this and just think it's perfectly normal. So, you know, this is where we have a long way to go to kind of raise awareness about why this matters. You know, and it matters because these people aren't speaking for themselves. They may not even know who themselves is at this point, you know. And their first loyalty is generally to their cult and not to, for instance, their constituents or the country, you know. And I'm sure there's others that you know, these are just the two that are at the top of my head. That I happen to know about. And, you know, I'm sure it's also true of the Labour Party. I'm not going to be partisan about this. You know, there are these ultra-left cults that I'm well aware of, and there are probably certainly councillors who belong to them. I don't know about MPs. So I guess I partly think it's a historic moment where we're at. So I often talk about the how did we get the coercive control law in the first place? Well, that's the result of a movement. That didn't just appear because someone suddenly thought it was a good idea to look after people who are getting psychologically controlled in their homes. That's really the result of a long process from the 70s where feminists and the women's movement started bringing attention to domestic violence. And then that became kind of understood after many years in the mainstream, and there were laws against domestic violence. Then after that, it was like, well, actually, it's not always about just the violence. That also goes with psychological control. And with a load of people doing a lot of work, they got this law. So the way I look at this is we have to also build a movement. And I think we are building a movement of people who are telling their stories and speaking out. And I don't really know how to do this. And anyone who does, we need help, you know. But we need to create enough pressure that overrides the sort of indifference of government to say this is a really serious problem. And, you know, there's child abuse, there's sexual abuse, there's financial abuse, there's physical abuse, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, it overlaps with terrorism, which you all seem to care so much about. It's just you only care when the violence is directed outside the group, and you don't care when the violence is in the group. But that internal violence often is part of what ends up as being external violence, so you should care. Anyway, I could go on. But so I think we just have to really push at this, that these things don't happen without a lot of effort from a lot of people. But I think the timing is good right now because so many people are becoming aware and speaking out and getting involved. So in that sense, I'm optimistic.
So there is the option for people to donate to the Family Survival Trust. What other things can us everyday people, what can we be doing to add to this pressure in our everyday lives? I try and have conversations with people outside of the podcast about cults and coercive control. I've had friends come to me about difficult relationships that they've been in, where I've sat down and said, have you considered that there are elements of this happening, where people have either not wanted to listen to me, which of course you can't push it at that point because you threaten the friendship then. But other people that have said, oh my goodness, I didn't even realize. And then gaslighting is the word of the year. So what else can we be doing to add to the pressure of this and to help the efforts of charities like the Family Survival Trust?
Well, I think what you're doing is really important. You know, talking to friends and neighbors, I think, is really important. I mean, whenever I talk to somebody, I mean, this happened, you know, I went and got a sports massage the other day for my funky shoulder. The lovely young woman, they, you know, asked what I do, and I tell her, and then right away she's talking about her brother who was in something, blah, blah, blah. This happens to be in kind of every conversation, right? But those conversations are really useful because you help people understand what it is and you give a language. Like you said, you know, you talk about coercive control and people go, oh, yeah. And that is really, really helpful. So I think just that talking about it with friends and neighbors. I really think going to one's MP, and I mean, I've struggled to understand British politics because I spent most of my adult life in America. But what I understand is if you go to the MP surgery, they have to listen to you and they have to give you a response. And I think if enough of us are doing that, whether it's about a particular cult experience of your own or your family or friends, or whether it's a general concern and bringing our report, for instance, and saying this shouldn't be happening in our community. Of course, it's always better if you have a personal story and try to get their attention. Now, you're not going to get instant results, but it's part of helping them get aware. Supporting any activities that you know are going on. I mean, that's a bit tricky because, you know, we're still a bit sparse on, I mean, this wonderful young woman from United Church of the Kingdom of God, ex-member, you know, was doing demonstrations down in Brixton, you know, but there's not a lot of that. What else? I think all the people telling their stories is hugely important. I think that's a big piece of it. Yeah, I guess that's, if we welcome ideas from people who know how to do campaigning. You know, we need people with that experience to work on this.
I find something that's really something that's really helpful as well that I've found is that if you create a wish list on the big corporate giant, all the books that you would like to read in regards to people's personal experiences or educational texts that have been written about the subject of cults, occasionally these books go on sale and you can get them at really, really low prices. I think there was just a couple of months ago, Faith Jones reduced the copy of Sex, Cult, Nun, the paperback that she's had officially published on her experiences growing up in the Children of God. It was like $2 or something like that. It was such a low price. So I think what's a really good idea is if you have a list of books that you would like to read, but books can be pricey and expensive and there's so many out there, so it's hard to choose. If you give yourself like even a small, like an one Audible token a month or something like that, it's hard to choose what book to read next. So what I've been doing is looking out for any special offers that have been on those books as well. So I think that's one idea that we can educate ourselves, mm-hmm. is by keeping an eye out for those reductions in book prices, and also just to check out websites like the Family Survival Trust, because I'm sure on that website there's some signposting to other websites, resources, people working in the space.
Well, this is one reason we need donations, because our website needs quite a serious upgrade. So, you know, that's not, I mean, we have some of that, but I'm not going to advertise that as being a lot. But, you know, as you're talking, and I'm thinking, you know, if for people who know there are cults in their community, you know, like especially around Christmas and stuff, you know, these, like if you get people trying to raise money in front of the high street, and you know that that's a cult, you know, go complain to the supermarkets, you know, just be loud about when you see cult activity, you know, whether it's the supermarkets or the MPs or the whoever it is, or the council, say, do you know what's happening in this group and why are they being allowed to do this? I think that's also important.
I think that's a great point. And I know that it doesn't always work, but we've seen it, we've seen examples of where that has had the right response from like theatres, for example, and spaces where people may come to do their live talks. There was a group of people that reported to their local theatre that they didn't want Teal Swan to do a show, and that got cancelled. And we saw that in the Surviving R. Kelly documentary as well. The group of women who came from the Time's Up movement, who were specifically talking about women of colour who were being targeted within communities. And of course, we know now that historically R. Kelly's victims were within that demographic. They were almost responsible for the re-interest that law enforcement had, and the whole cancelling of R. Kelly and his shows. And I think that there are examples that we can look at where it's been positive, where it's stopped potential predators from visiting your community. And that was the initial worry. The initial worry was, we don't want these people in our area, because if they're in our area, then there is the chance that vulnerable people within our community can be impacted and almost recruited by the presence of these individuals. So and I'm sure if anybody has a specific question, if there's a group in their area, if there's a personal story that they have to share, or they access the report on the Family Survival Trust website and take a copy, that there are always individuals like yourself, Alex, that people can email and say, how do I word this? I don't, what's the best way to show up to a place like an MP's office and word it so that it sounds like I know what I'm talking about? Because sometimes these things can be hard to explain.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the other place, of course, where a lot of cults are in the schools and the universities. So, you know, if you're a parent or a student, I mean, even the primary schools now, there's all this meditation and mindfulness stuff coming in. You know, I would want to query who's bringing that in and then Google them and find out who they're associated with, because a lot of cults are coming into the schools that way. And the universities, you know, the campuses are absolutely chock-a-block with cult recruitment. So, you know, complain to the university, say, why are you letting these people on campus? You know, be loud.
Hopefully one day they'll add something into the curriculum where people can be made aware of these types of environments from an early age.
I mean, I had tried very hard when I first got here, because I was teaching a university course in America. And then anyway, that's a long story. But, you know, I've kind of proposed things at various universities and the level of interest has been zero so far. Well, I had one university had a brief flurry of interest, but we should be teaching it in all our educational establishments. And it's highly teachable. It's not impossible to do at all. So anyway, we have a long way to go, but we are making progress. We are not static. We're definitely moving forward. We just have to keep going.
It would be so interesting to come from like a psychology lecture where they probably talk about cults and coercive control, at least in some parts of the curriculum that's taught, and then to get approached by somebody that's like, do you want to come to a Bible study? And you're like, actually, do you know what? I don't think I do, because I've just come from my psychology class where I've been learning about transitional periods and when I'm most vulnerable.
That happens. I mean, there's a wonderful woman in North London who teaches, junior school, high school. Anyway, I think sort of older kids. She has a very good prevention program. And they come to her and they say, oh, such and such approached me on the street. And they know what it is now. So, you know, we know that education is a very powerful preventive tool. We just got to get on it.
I am so excited to be here and be a small part of it as well, because I feel like we will see a lot of change in the next 10 years, and I feel like I can feel that it's going to happen, but it's just kind of like not knowing when. So that's kind of exciting, and the subject itself also just fascinates me, and people just interest me as well. So I'm hoping to strap myself in for the long haul and be a part of all of the activism, exposing and prevention work that is taking place all around the world. It's still weird to me because I speak to so many people that aren't in this country, to then speak to yourself, who's like, yes, so cults are all around us in this country. And I think it again is one of those things where we need to recognize that it isn't just happening away from us. It's on our doorstep, and we need to be responsible for educating ourselves and others to stop that from being a thing. And then hopefully, you know, government law and legislation and follows suit with all of that as well. So I guess that just leaves me to ask you, Dr. Alexandra Stain, not Stein. Is that right?
That's right. Though I don't care when people get it wrong. I really don't. But yes, it is Stain.
I probably should have opened on that with clarification at the start of the episode. Maybe I'll edit this into the beginning. So thank you so much, Alex, for coming to talk with me today, so close to Christmas. I really appreciate the time that you've given me, and that you've published Inside Out, and that you've published Terror, Love and Brainwashing, and that you are part of the Family Survival Trust and continue your efforts every day to tackle the subject of cults and coercion and to help the rest of us become educated in the field as well. You've listed so many different people that have contributed to either sociology or psychology and studies, and people who have written books and experiment titles that have taken place. And I just think that if anybody wanted a place to start, they could listen back to this interview, write a list of all of the people you've said, and that would give them a good couple of months worth of stuff to go through. So I think you're absolutely a powerhouse of information, and I appreciate you so much being here to talk with me today and offer your some of your education and experience to the listeners.
Well, you're most welcome, and I hope people enjoy listening and get something from it. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Alex. I'll speak to you soon. Take care.
Bye-bye.
That is the end of this mini-series with Dr. Alexandra Stain. For more information on Alexandra's work, please follow the links in the episode description. To get in touch with me, you can find me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or follow me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, host of the Cult Vault podcast.